Hello and welcome to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. Today we revisit one of the landmark court cases of the 20th century, one which brought us the banality of evil on our television screens. In early 1961, the world was transfixed by events unfolding in a makeshift courtroom in Jerusalem, where a small, thin-haired man locked inside a bulletproof glass booth stood trial for the murder of millions of Jews in the Holocaust. Regarded as one of the architects of the final solution, Adolf Eichmann spent 16 years in hiding in Argentina until he was dramatically hunted down and captured on the streets of Buenos Aires by Israel's secret service agency, Mossad. The manner of his arrest generated worldwide controversy, as did the Israeli government's insistence that it should hold the trial, which would be filmed and broadcast on television for all the world to bear witness. British journalist Gavin Esler travels to Israel to speak with some of the key people involved in the capture and the trial of Adolf Eichmann.
Just before 9 o'clock in the morning on the 11th of April 1961, a balding middle-aged man in a dark suit was led into this hall where I'm standing now. He didn't have any claws or fangs. In fact, all he had was a cold. He kept dabbing his nose with a handkerchief. But as he silently entered the packed room, there was an audible gasp.
Adolf Eichmann. Tagit lo lakum.
The man was Adolf Eichmann, a Nazi officer who organized the deportation of millions of Jews and others to the death camps. In the confusion at the end of the Second World War, he slipped away from Germany and eventually turned up in Argentina, until he was snatched in a dramatic kidnap operation by the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service. Eichmann was smuggled to Israel, and one of the most important trials in history started right here where I'm standing.
In Jerusalem, the trial of Adolf Eichmann begins, reviving memories of the Nazi horrors of the Second World War.
Today it's the Gerhard Behar Concert Auditorium. Then it was a cultural centre, hastily converted for the trial, called Beit Ha'am, the House of the People.
Searching problems of conscience and of international law will be raised by this trial.
The chief prosecutor, Gideon Hausner, was fully conscious of the weight of history behind him, and he started his case very dramatically. He stood up just over there in front of what is now the stage, and he said, "When I stand before you, judges of Israel, in this court to accuse Adolf Eichmann, I do not stand alone. Here with me at this moment stand 6 million prosecutors." He was speaking not for himself, not for the state of Israel, but also for all those who died in the Holocaust. With me here is Tammy Rave, who's Gideon Hausner's daughter and these days a lawyer herself in Jerusalem. I'm just trying to get the geography in my head. I think your father would have been over here, wouldn't he? In the front row of the seats,
yeah,
something like that.
Something like that.
Right in front
and
of the stage.
Glass booth was here over there.
So Eichmann would have been where those stairs are to lead up to this,
something like
or
that.
In the corner of the
stage.
Yeah,
they change it here, but somewhere here.
What does this place mean to you?
Lots of memories of childhood. I was in school, and the young people in Israel, they knew very little about the Holocaust. And actually, I think they mocked a little the people who came from there. They thought the survivors, they did not fight and heal. They were heroes. They fought the independence war for the state of Israel. My father said after the trial, the young people in Israel realized the big heroism was to survive from one day to another. That was a very important message for the people in Israel.
At the time of the trial, some 60% of Israelis aged 14 or over were listening to the live radio broadcast of the opening session. In fact, the trial was one of the first truly global news events transmitted right around the world. Israel then was actually a young country, just 13 years old. Israelis sometimes joke that if the country had been a person, it would have been the year of its bar mitzvah. And perhaps this trial was some kind of coming of age. I'm here in Jerusalem, not far from the Old City, going to see one of Israel's leading historians. Tom Segev is a journalist who's written several books on the impact of the Holocaust.
You need to understand that Eichmann symbolized the Holocaust because Eichmann had been the most senior Nazi official to negotiate with Jewish representatives in Europe. For the Jews, there were two Adolfs, Adolf Hitler and Adolf Eichmann. For years, David Ben-Gurion, the prime minister, had done next to nothing related to the search for Nazi criminals. Israel before 1960 was still very much in the process of nation building, and it was a very future-oriented country, struggling for security, for economy, and for some kind of national collective identity. It actually took the German Fritz Bauer, who had gained the information independently that Eichmann was living in Argentina, and kept pushing Israel. Unless you do something, I have to inform my government. And if I do, they will ask for his extradition and he will be gone. And Ben-Gurion realized that there are things to gain from the trial. He felt that the Israeli society needs some big national experience, such as experiencing the Holocaust.
Rafi Eitan nowadays is chairman of the National Council for Jewish Restitution in Tel Aviv, but in 1960 he was a member of the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service. He led the team, which included a specialist in unarmed combat, Peter Malkin, that travelled to Buenos Aires to capture Eichmann.
We knew the way that he walked from the bus to his house, and we decided to ambush him. Peter Malkin, handsome man, jumped on him. He yelled, and later he told us that he felt he was captured by the Israelis.
What did you think of this person that was in front of you?
I felt he was completely average, very limited thinking about the surrounding.
You still had one problem. You'd got him, but you still had to get him out of Buenos Aires. How difficult was that?
The plane that was specialized for the operation arrived in the Argentine on the 20th of May. So we dressed myself and also Eichmann in uniforms of technical people, and it was very easy to put him inside the plane and inside the plane in a normal seat.
It sounds like James Bond.
Well, if you watch me walking in the street, I'm half of James Bond.
We've come to the State Archives. Joining us is Avram Berg, who's a writer and a politician. He was once the Speaker of the Knesset, the Israeli Parliament, following in the footsteps of his father, Yosef Berg, a member of Ben-Gurion's cabinet at the time.
So let me take you a tour, a virtual tour into history. Nobody knows what's going on. There is an announcement to the Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion. I have to tell the Knesset that a short while ago was discovered by the Israeli security services, one of the greatest Nazi criminals, Adolf Eichmann, is already in prison in Israel and soon will be brought to trial in Israel according to the law of doing justice in the Nazis and their collaborators. This is how it happened.
Snatching Eichmann caused a diplomatic row. Argentina was furious that official channels had been ignored and its sovereignty had been violated. The United Nations condemned Israel's actions, and Israel tried to claim that the operation had been carried out by private citizens without official backing. Some prominent Jewish leaders even suggested that to defuse the situation, Eichmann should be tried by an international tribunal representing all the countries affected by his crimes.
Ben-Gurion resisted that. No, only here Hitler wanted to exterminate the Jewish people. It's for the rest of the Jewish people to try him.
Yitzhak Navon is a former president of Israel. At the time, he was the political secretary of the Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion.
What was striking for many was the man, Eichmann. What kind of a person is that? That skinny little thing. He could murder, burn, slaughter a million children. That's bastard. Look at him. He's not a giant. He's not a normal man, a shopkeeper or what.
Is that still difficult to understand? You know, there he was, this nobody, and yet he was a monster at the same time.
Yes, it can be. That's to say that you never know. Suddenly, all of us saw that what can befall these days on this 20th century, such a slaughter. How do we defend ourselves? What can we do in order to avoid a repetition of such atrocities? It's very disturbing. Very disturbing, really.
For me, the Holocaust is not something that happened by Germans to Jews. It is something that happened by human beings to human beings. When you think about the fact that during the 20th century, more than 160 million people were perished and killed and persecuted in crimes against humanity. That's a huge number. And therefore, for me, the never again is not never again to Jews. No, for me, never again is never again to any human being, wherever she or he are. And therefore, to say we just bring Eichmann to trial to Israel by Jews and by Israeli, etc., is like confiscating the monopoly over the symbol and say it's ours only. And I say it's not ours only.
Michael Goldman Gilad is a survivor.
I hope it's okay. This is homemade. It's a simple cake.
Homemade. Okay. Absolutely. He survived Auschwitz and came to Israel. There he joined the police and he worked as an interrogator on the Eichmann case.
When I first met him, he looked like a Nebuch.
So, a nobody, nothing.
When they brought him into the interview room, he would stand up. Only when he was given permission to sit down, then he would sit down. This was one of his little tricks. He wanted to try to establish that he would only do what he was told.
He received an order, he do it.
For example, for every meal, as well as the food, he would get two slices of bread. One day he asked whether it was permissible for him not to eat both slices of bread.
You understand how clever he was? Order is order.
You know, we had testimony from the trial of Rudolf Hess, the commandant of Auschwitz.
Rudolf Hess, Mifaket shel Auschwitz.
Eichmann came to Auschwitz at one point and demanded to know why Hess was selecting, putting some people into the work camp and sending only some people to die. Eichmann said, anybody who is allowed to live could escape, could turn against us, could seek revenge at some time in the future. I'm one of the people who was selected at Auschwitz, and I escaped, and in the end I turned out to be his interrogator. So he was right. What he said was right.
Hausner didn't know, the chief prosecutor didn't know your past. I mean, he knew in general, but he did not know specifically.
We didn't talk about it. When we survivors came to Israel and started to talk a little bit about it because people asked, we saw that they didn't believe us.
They didn't believe you. Why didn't they believe you?
It was impossible to believe.
Because it was so horrible.
It was so horrible. So You have to understand it.
We didn't talk, but the Eichmann trial opened our mouths again.
The Jerusalem courtroom trying Adolf Eichmann was a chamber of horrors today, as one witness after another took the stand to describe a different aspect of the fate of the Jews of Poland. At one point today, a witness paused and asked the court, "Are you interested in my continuing my story?" The prosecutor replied, "Interested, yes. The question is, have we got the strength?" This is Jeffrey Wigger in Jerusalem. I return you to Radio Newsreel in London.
The historian Tom Segev was 16 years old at the time. He wasn't allowed into the courtroom, but he did join the crowds watching relay screens set up in the street nearby.
There's no question about it that this was a major event. The Eichmann trial made the Holocaust, for the first time, what it is today, a major element of the Israeli identity. If you go to a high school in Israel and ask the children, "Are you a Holocaust survivor?" 8 out of 10 Israeli high school kids will tell you, "Yes, I am a Holocaust survivor." Why are you a Holocaust survivor? You were born in Israel, your parents come from Morocco. Why are you a Holocaust survivor? I'm a Holocaust survivor because it's so much part of the Israeli identity. It influences the way we are, the way we feel. It influences our attitude towards, for example, today, the danger from Iran. And it began with the Eichmann trial.
I've come to one of the suburbs just outside Tel Aviv to meet Professor Hannah Yablonka, who is professor at Ben-Gurion University, one of Israel's leading authorities on the Holocaust or Shoah, and also on the identity of contemporary Jews.
It actually imprinted in many Israelis the feeling that we are doomed. We are a doomed nation. The world is after us to exterminate us.
Is there anything of the trial that could have been done differently? Is there any way in which that past could have been explained in a way which now would make Israel a better country?
I don't think that the trial could have been conducted differently. The question was, what happened to the educational system responding to the trial? And it goes, to a large extent, to the Shoah. For instance, I told you that Shoah is a mandatory subject to matriculation exams in Israel. War of Independence is not. I do believe that our students should learn more about the state, the history of the state, and not from the point of view of an eternal victim, but rather as a nation that is responsible and has the ability to shape its life, present and future, which is really something that we lost over the 50 years of education that followed the Eichmann trial for many youngsters.
Well, this was the whole of the prosecution team. This was me, looking even younger than today.
In 1961, Gabriel Bach was the young deputy prosecutor working closely with the chief prosecutor, Gideon Hausner. The defense counsel was a West German lawyer named Dr. Robert Servatius. Right from the start, he challenged the legal basis of the trial, and he argued that Eichmann was just a minor figure who was only following orders.
He was not just someone who received orders and carried out orders. He even countermanded Hitler's orders, where he thought that that might mean the saving of a few Jews.
You had to go through this day after day for months. Did it not have a terrible effect on you? Did you not find it very difficult?
Well, we had evidence that the first Jews who were sent from Hungary to Auschwitz, before they were put into the gas chambers, they were forced to write postcards to their friends and their families. And that was dictated by Eichmann. They had to write, "We are here in a beautiful country resort, only light work, but not enough room. So please come as quickly as possible." So I heard there was a Jew in Israeli who had such a postcard and lived. He described how they got to Auschwitz. He described the selection. His wife, to the left, he had a little daughter was 2.5 years old, said to the left. So the witness said, and I looked. My wife was swallowed up in the crowd. I couldn't see her anymore. But my little daughter, she had a red coat. And that little red dot, getting smaller and smaller, this is how my family disappeared from my life. Now, I had a daughter at that time who was 2.5 years old, and I had bought her a red coat just 2 weeks before that. So when the witness said that, it cut off my throat. I couldn't utter a word. And it took a few minutes before I managed to get under control again.
In trying to come to terms with Eichmann and what he did, the political theorist Hannah Arendt coined the term the banality of evil. She saw Eichmann not as a monster, but as a mindless cog in a murderous bureaucracy. For many people, this view seemed to domesticate the enormity of what he'd done in a way that was unacceptable. Tom Segev again.
I once talked to her. To my amazement, she said, "Oh, yes, Eichmann in Jerusalem. It wasn't really a good book. This subtitle, banality of evil, everybody read much, much too much into it." And today, we know much more about Eichmann than she did, because Eichmann wrote a biography in jail. It shows how deeply committed Eichmann was to the ideology of Nazism. I think that what we know today about Eichmann doesn't substantiate the theory that it's just a banal nothing. Also, it doesn't support the theory which people then made out of these words, the banality of evil, as if everybody is capable of doing it. We can all be Nazis. No, we can't. We really have to believe in racist theory and anti-Semitism, in Nazism, and then we are Nazis.
When you walk around the centre of the old city of Jerusalem here, it's amazingly colourful. There's over there the people selling herbs and teas, and over here it's trinkets and knickknacks. There's a mixture of cultures and languages. It's incredibly lively. It is, of course, very divided. It's the dividing line between Arab and Jew, as everybody knows. It's full of life. And yet this city is the way it is now, as a result of a story which began with death.
Punctually at 9 o'clock on this grey, blustery morning, the three judges took their places on the bench. This court sentences Adolf Eichmann to death for the crimes against the Jewish people, the crimes against humanity, and the war crimes of which he has been found guilty. Eichmann heard his verdict, which took less than a minute to deliver, standing stiffly to attention, his head tilted slightly on one side, his lips pursed.
Adolf Eichmann was found guilty on December the 11th, 1961. Many influential figures, including the philosopher Martin Buber, argued against the death penalty. They felt one life could not compensate for the loss of 6 million lives, and the watching world would see the hanging of Eichmann as an act of vengeance by the Jewish people. But the appeal was rejected on the 29th of May 1962, and the only civil execution in the history of Israel took place the next day. Michael Goldman Gilad, who'd survived Auschwitz and became Eichmann's interrogator, was there.
אנחנו עמדנו בערך מטר וחצי ממנו.
We were a few feet away from him. When they put the noose around his neck, he said, "Long live Germany, long live Austria, long live Argentina. These are the three countries to which I have a loyalty. We'll all meet again sometime soon." And then Eichmann said a sentence that I'll never forget. He said,
"Ich war gottgläubig und sterbe gottgläubig."
I lived believing in God, and I'll die believing in God. And I said, "Good Lord, what God is this?"
שום רגש כשעמדתי מולו. שום רגש.
I felt absolutely no emotion at all standing there. No sense of pity, no sense of mercy, no sense of revenge. All I could think of was, what kind of God? What God is this? This mass murderer who didn't spare tiny babies. What God is it?
You also witnessed the cremation and the scattering of Eichmann's ashes in the sea outside Israeli waters. Was that for you then just a duty that you had to perform by that point?
כשהוציאו את האפר, כל האפר הוכנס לקאט של 2 liters שלא היה מלא בכלל.
When the ashes were taken out, they didn't nearly fill a 2-liter container. I was shocked to see how little there was left. I'm saying this because one day, it was November 1943, when I was at Birkenau, the concentration camp, about 20 of us were taken to the other side of the camp, to the crematorium. Next to this building, there was a great mountain of ash. There was a lot of snow and ice on the ground. We were told to take some ash in wheelbarrows and spread it over the paths so the SS officers wouldn't slip. When I saw the tiny amount that came from Eichmann, only then could I properly understand the enormity of what I'd seen in Birkenau. Afterwards, we took a police boat out from the Jaffa port. I and the head of the Israeli prison service poured the ashes into the water.
Mickey, the really strange thing when you talk about this to me is that we're talking about Eichmann, but in a peculiar way he's one of the least important people in all of this, although he made it all happen. This is a story about the people who survived and went on to convince the rest of the world about what happened.
That's right. We hanged one person. We couldn't hang him 6 million times. And when it was all over, I felt relieved. It was at midnight, the scattering of the ashes. As we returned, the sun was starting to come up. We saw the fishermen coming back to port. We saw the workers arriving for the morning. Buses passing. It was back to life. That's what I felt that morning. A sense of relief.
The Man in the Glass Box by British journalist Gavin Esler, about the capture and the trial and the execution of Adolf Eichmann. The program was produced by Kate Taylor for Whistledown Productions in the UK. Up next, we examine the impact of the Eichmann trial broadcasts when we switch on the TV inside an average American household in 1961. What did Americans see of the trial? What kind of TV viewing did it make? And what did they learn from it? You're listening to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. In 1961, Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion insisted that Israel had the moral right to put Adolf Eichmann on trial and that it should be seen around the world. But he couldn't have predicted the impact it would have, not only on Israel, but the rest of the world. The Eichmann trial was the first time a court case was allowed to be screened on television, and it was broadcast as live to those countries where TV had been introduced. The American company Capital Cities Broadcasting had been given the contract to film the trial. It had four concealed cameras inside the court, and each day for the full 5 months of the trial, it sent an hour-long taped recording back to America. Was it what Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion hoped for, a chance for the world to bear witness to the Holocaust and to never forget? Or did the Eichmann trial reveal more shockingly what the writer Hannah Arendt had called the banality of evil? US historian Jeffrey Shandler is the author of While America Watches, Televising the Holocaust, and he's speaking here with Hindsight's Michelle Rayner.
The story that had a grim preface in the horror of Nazi concentration camps comes to an equally grim end in Israel, as Adolf Eichmann is sentenced for his crimes against humanity. The three judges started to study the evidence when the four-month trial ended in August and found Eichmann guilty on 15 counts of the indictment. In his bulletproof booth, Eichmann sits stoically as the charges are summed up. The unseen witnesses against this former Gestapo colonel are the 6 million Jews he is convicted of slaughtering.
It's an interesting moment in television history in that during the 1950s, television, over the course of that decade, went from being a novelty to being a fixture in most American homes. By that point, it's become a fixture of American life. But it's a new fixture, and the medium was not without controversy. First of all, as a source for news, it was considered limited at best, and if your serious source for news was print. This was a time where there were many more newspapers in the United States, and you often had morning newspapers and afternoon newspapers, and that was the main source of news, information, and analysis. And television was rather light. Television was also trying to establish its bona fides after some scandals, including the blacklisting of performers and writers who were suspected of being communists. And there were scandals about game shows that had been rigged so that the players that the producers of the show wanted to win won, and the ones that they didn't want to win lost, which is not how a game show is supposed to work. And when this was exposed, this obviously was a serious problem for the integrity of television. So there was a concern at the time of a need to establish that the medium could be used for good. So the broadcasters who were broadcasting the Eichmann trial saw this as an opportunity to say, we're going to be doing something very serious and very important. It's not going to be entertaining. It's not going to be something we're doing to push product. And we are going to do this as a way of establishing television as a legitimate source for news, because watching the trial as opposed to reading about it is going to give you information that is unique to this medium. It will be as if you were sitting in the courtroom. And in particular, they focused on the defendant, on Eichmann, less on the importance of the witnesses, than you would be able to see this man accused of monstrous crimes and judge for yourself what kind of a man was he. And an interesting thing that emerged in this discourse, because most Americans had no direct connection to the Holocaust. It's different than, say, the discourse you would have in Germany or the discourse you would have in Israel, a different kind of connection. But most Americans, no direct connection. So a lot of the discussion was that this was a kind of ultimate case study in the nature of the human capacity for evil. And so one of the advertisements to encourage people to watch the trial said, when you watch Eichmann, you are also watching yourself. This is a kind of psychological case study in the nature of human morality, which is quite remarkable that that was the way it was framed for this American audience. So irrespective of whether you were had a personal connection to the Holocaust or were interested in it in any way, you are interested in the question of evil. And that's why you should watch this. And that's how it was framed as a kind of universal psychological phenomenon.
When I stand before you, judges of Israel, in this court to accuse Adolf Eichmann, I do not stand alone. Here with me at this moment stand 6 million prosecutors. But alas, they cannot rise to level the finger of accusation in the direction of the glass dock and cry out j'accuse against the man who sits there, because their ashes have been piled up in the mounds of Auschwitz and the fields of Treblinka, or spilled into the rivers of Poland, and their graves are scattered throughout the length and breadth of Europe. Their blood cries to heaven, but their voice cannot be heard.
The trial fell into two different parts. So the case of the prosecution, which included both a very stentorian prosecutor with a real flair for the dramatic in terms of how he made his case, and this long series of dozens of witnesses describing the full extent of the Nazi persecution of European Jewry, which the defense kept arguing was not germane to Eichmann per se, but this information was presented nonetheless. That was the first part. And the second part was just Eichmann. Eichmann had no witnesses for the defense. He was asked to go over documents and to explain certain moments. And it went from being this very extensive, sometimes very histrionic presentation by the witnesses for the prosecution, what one journalist dubbed Jewish folk opera, to something that was very bureaucratic and very unspectacular.
A very strange kind of anticlimax, too, you'd think. If
yes, I mean, this is, but of course, this is true of trials generally. They're not theater, they're not drama. They have their own way of working. And in fact, some people will argue that when they get too much about drama, they are not doing justice. So the idea that justice and drama are inimical is something you'll find many people feel about the way a trial should unfold.
So then what did American viewers see from the Eichmann trial?
Well, to begin with, every day the full day's proceedings, which were recorded on a videotape, were edited down to 1 hour's worth of highlights. Copies were made onto both video and film and distributed to various countries and various broadcasters or newsreel studios or whoever was to receive the material that was sort of sent out internationally on airplanes. In the United States, if you lived in New York City, you could watch the full hour of highlights of the proceedings day's trial because it took that long. There were no direct flights. So the fact that they could get it the next day, that was considered actually pushing the envelope. Now that sounds very sort of creaky. But this is before you had satellite transmission. So they could see the previous day's trial complete. The national news would take highlights of the trial, and that would be included in nightly reports. There were networks that did weekend documentaries summing up what had happened in the trial on a periodic basis. Capital Cities Broadcasting Company, which had gotten the contract with the Israeli government to create the one video documentation, they made their own documentary that was shown on television after the trial was over, but before the verdict was handed down. So that was sometime in the fall of 1961.
And then there was my father's sister. She was also, she had children in her arms, and she was shot on the spot with the children, with the babies in her arms.
And finally, it was your turn.
My turn came.
So the trial was conducted in two languages. The official languages of the trial were Hebrew, the state language of Israel, and German, the language of the defendant. And the way the trial was conducted was, which you can see in the original footage, was that someone would speak in Hebrew, stop, and then it was translated into German, and this was done sequentially, not simultaneously, which means that the often protracted nature of trial proceedings was doubly protracted. And a lot of what you see in the unedited footage is people waiting around while they're being translated into a language they don't necessarily understand. The Israeli judges who were hearing the trial, was a tribunal of three judges. It's not like a jury trial, it was a judge trial. They were all German Jews. They all knew German. But they would almost always only speak in Hebrew because that was the language in which they were supposed to speak. Hmm. Also, at the same time the trial was being translated into English and French for journalists, and that was also recorded. So when this was shown in the United States, it was actually kind of confusing because you would hear people speaking in the background in German or in Hebrew, and then dubbed over it, you would hear English. And it was challenging audially, I think, for the average listener. And occasionally, you would have either Eichmann or Gideon Hausner, the prosecutor, or other people speaking, being translated in a female voice, or occasionally you had female witnesses being translated by male voices. And that could also just create another level of this discontinuity. There are these long stretches where, when you're watching, where you have Eichmann sitting and waiting either to be translated or have what somebody said being translated, just staring. And I think that footage added to the sense of somebody who was just disassociated with what was going on, you know, that just cut off from the moral implications of what he had done.
In the ninth week of his Jerusalem trial for the murder of 6 million Jews, Adolf Eichmann takes the stand in his bulletproof dock. He refuses to take an oath on the New Testament proffered him, saying that he belongs to no religion. He does swear on the name of God, in whom he says he believes. Under the guidance of defense attorney Dr. Robert Servetius, the visibly tired but unshaken prisoner pleads innocent of all charges laid against him. He uses the plea that he was not responsible for any of the deaths ascribed to him, as he was only a minor bureaucrat, a cog, carrying out the orders of his superiors. He repudiates a confession the prosecution asserts he signed when captured in Argentina.
What is so interesting is that both people who are in the courtroom covering the trial for print media, people watching on television, came away with a very similar response when they looked at Eichmann. And they said, he looks like my accountant. He looks like my dentist. He looks like my pharmacist. He looked like an ordinary person. And when he was engaged in the trial, in the second half of the trial, he seemed like a very fussy, arrogant, but bureaucratic functionary. Did not seem monstrous. And that proved, I think, very frustrating, that you could see someone who, you know, the evidence was clear, had been the head of a truly horrific operation of leading millions of people to their murder simply for who they were, and that he would present as an ordinary guy in a suit and tie. And this was really frustrating for observers across the board, seasoned journalists, as well as, you know, the average family watching this on television. And that created, I think, well, there are a couple of consequences to this, one of which is that when in 1963 Hannah Arendt published her account first in The New Yorker and then as a book on the Eichmann trial, Eichmann in Jerusalem, and she coined, actually, it's the very end of the book, this concept of banality of evil, that this wound up becoming the main takeaway for many people of the book, even though the book has a lot of other things to say. I think that that took root with Americans, certainly, because that lined up with this unspectacular spectacle of Eichmann as this utterly ordinary person who had done such utterly horrible things.
I had to obey. I was at the time in uniform, and there was a war on.
I think that the, you know, the challenge was that the image, not only in you know, necessarily in Israel, but a sort of worldwide image of Nazis as monstrous figures just didn't connect to the man you were seeing on trial. And that was, for some people, disappointing. For some people, that was more disturbing. That this ordinariness was part of who he was, and that within the ordinariness was something that was anything but ordinary. And that was something that television did not ameliorate or alleviate. It complicated it. And I think in productive ways for thoughtful people, it made them stop and think about what is your assumption about how evil people are supposed to appear or act, and conversely, good people or ordinary people. It challenged those kinds of expectations. What I found interesting was at the same time there were a couple of television dramas that were made either before or during the trial about Eichmann, or a sort of science fiction program. The Twilight Zone had a drama that's very clearly based on an Eichmann-like character. And in both of those, the Eichmann figure are demonstrably, lip-curlingly raving sadists. And it was everything but what the trial was. The trial was long, attenuated. It was not satisfying as melodrama. And it was, in a way, an object lesson in the difference between fantasies about how you imagine evil people and that they ought to be brought to justice, and the actualities of many of these figures, and the challenge of what it means to bring somebody, especially in cases of genocide, you know, what does it mean to try and bring someone like this to justice? And this has become part of the legacy of the trial. There have been more dramas about Eichmann that have been made using the device of melodrama, of bringing to the surface what was going on inside of him, which didn't happen in the actual trial. He remained an enigmatic figure at that level. There's also been assessments of what is the significance of the trial as, first of all, a marker in Holocaust remembrance, especially in Israel, as an opportunity which was not necessarily anticipated, certainly not anticipated in the United States, that this would bring unprecedented attention to Holocaust survivors and their stories, and that this really marks the beginning of paying attention to them in the public sphere in a new way. Holocaust survivors, many of them had been telling their stories from the get-go, but largely to one another. At this point, they are now on a national and international stage in a way that they really hadn't been before in a sustained way. And this marks a signal shift in a new kind of attention to the primacy of eyewitnesses to genocide. For me, what was interesting was to think of it as a landmark in American television history that got lost in the shuffle. And when I started researching this topic, I discovered that books on the history of American television either didn't mention it at all, or it was mentioned in passing. Mm. And I thought, well, that's really surprising. This is the first major trial to be televised internationally. It's maybe the first trial of any kind to be televised internationally. And it involved what was state of the art in terms of what does it take to do that. A few years later, you had satellites and all of this looked old hat. But it was curious to me that that didn't become part of this narrative. And I think it's because it had proved so challenging to people. It wasn't what they expected it would be. Apparently, viewership, especially once Eichmann is on the stand, starts to drop off because people don't want to watch him. And, you know, covering this long attenuated event was not something that American television had really done before. So all of this made it a problematic landmark. And problematic landmarks sometimes drop out of the narrative. But I think it belongs in there in understanding the evolution of this medium, and certainly in its relationship to dealing with history and also dealing with the public being witness to justice being served.
This court sentences Adolf Eichmann to death.
On June 1st, 1962, Adolf Eichmann was hanged for crimes against the Jewish people. Standing under the gallows before witnesses to his execution, he spoke his final words.
Long live Germany. Long live Austria. Long live Argentina. I owe a lot to these countries, and I shall not forget them. I had to obey the rules of war and my flag.
Historian Jeffrey Shandler, author of While America Watches, Televising the Holocaust. He was speaking with Hindsight's Michelle Rayner.